What I'd like to do is to go a little bit further than what Tom was able to do just in the amount of time that he had. I won't go. We have some things that overlap. I'm not going to go over the ground that he covered. But I would like to apply some of what he talked about, I think a little more specifically to the local church and then more specifically to theological education. Because I think in large part the reason business people and working place folks have the attitudes about their work that they do is largely because they learn it from us in the church. And so changing the way the next generation of pastors addresses business people and talks about their own work in the local church vis-a-vis what goes on in the rest of the workplace seems to me is a really important thing to invest in the next generation of pastors to do. So I come to this with kind of a unique, I don't know, maybe not unique, but quite a mixture of emphases. I have an undergraduate degree in economics that when I started my seminary degree, I began immediately to wonder, you know, what good will my economics degree ever be again? I didn't tell my dad that, who had funded my college education. And there wasn't very much, though I deeply appreciate what I learned in my seminary degree, there wasn't anything in that curriculum that helped dissuade me of the notion that my economics degree was going to have any value whatsoever. And it wasn't until about, probably 10, 15 years ago when I started thinking more seriously about a theology of work and about to sort of complement what I had done in teaching business ethics, that I began to think, you know, maybe this is really quite a lot more relevant than I thought. And God worked in a very strange way to bring that back full circle in a very encouraging way. But I am by no means an economist. I know enough to be conversant, but I won't claim the same kind of background that David has. The other thing that has been an influence in my thinking in this is my dad was an entrepreneur. And I remember really vividly sitting around the dinner table when I was in middle school listening to my dad talk about his plans to go into business for himself. And he told us quite forthrightly that he was putting all of our college funds into his new business. And then if it failed, we were on our own for college. And we were all pulling for this thing to succeed. And this, I think this maybe it may have been one of the reasons why my siblings and I worked in that business from about the time we were, I remember sleeping floors in that company when I was 12. And I suspect violating all sorts of, today what would be child labor laws. And I remember very vividly working when I was in between my summers as a high school student, working, you know, 6-7 days a week, 10-12 hours a day, running a printing press in that plant. And when my dad eventually came to faith, it was as an adult, and it was after my brother and I had come to faith, and our initial conversations about our conversion and the suggestion that my mom and dad were in a little different place, spiritually speaking, let's just say that was not particularly well received in our house. But eventually, God got a hold of them. They actually spent many, many years in a Southern Baptist church in Texas, which I hold almost entirely responsible for their spiritual growth. But my dad was a very successful business person, and about the only way he connected his business with his spiritual life is what is the money that generated for him to give to his local church. And I think he engaged in many Christian business practices without even knowing it or even knowing what to call it. But the only way that he was ever conscious of the intersection of his business with his spiritual life was when it came time to write checks to the local church. And I remember thinking, there's something not quite right with that picture, even though I couldn't articulate it quite at the time. And then a third sort of, you know, I teach seminary students, I teach business students, I teach ethics in the business school at Biola University. I teach grad philosophy students. So especially the combination of seminary students and business students is a nice foot in both of those worlds. And we did, you know, we did a retreat much like this one for our Talbot faculty a few years ago. And it was, for many of our faculty, it was the first time they had given this much thought. And I think one of the things that I wish we had done a little bit better job of was communicating why this stuff was so important for a theological curriculum. That I think that's where we dropped the ball on this in the first time around, which is why I'm so glad we had this, all the introductory stuff that you did, David. Because I am totally convinced that the average seminary student that you and I minister to, the people that they will serve in their churches, despite your statistics about the amount of leisure time going off the charts, I don't see that in my life, by the way. I wanted to ask you about that. They will spend the vast majority of their waking hours in the workplace. And I contend, and we'll talk a little bit more about this tomorrow, that the workplace, not the local church, is the primary crucible in which their spiritual formation gets worked out. And it seems to me one of the primary roles of the pastor is to help our workplace people be attentive to the ways in which God is forming them spiritually in the workplace. And yet, most of my seminary students don't have a clue about anything that relates to the world in which the business, professional, and workplace folks that they minister to are engaged in day after day and week after week. And the idea of going to visit someone in their workplace is an entirely foreign concept to them. In fact, we have worked into our curriculum in the field education component of our MDiv program. We now have a standing assignment that requires them to visit at least once. I wish we did it more often. But at least they have to visit at least one business person one time in their office, and we have five questions that they have to ask them. And one of those has to do with the various ethical issues that they face. I contend for most of our seminary students, I tell them, if you begin to preach and teach about things that have to do with the workplace, you better have a cardiologist on standby, because most of the people, they're not going to know what hit them when those things come to be talked about. Inadvertently, what I think we have done, what I think we are equipping our future pastors to do, is to disciple people into an essentially privatized faith, where their relationship with God privately, perhaps as it relates to their marriage and family, but I think we are inadvertently and unintentionally reinforcing the church on Sunday, work on Monday, as two separate spheres. So this, I am totally convinced that if we are to retain the business community as a place where there is still a more than reasonable Christian presence, a vital Christian presence, that it's one of the few segments of culture where I think that's true, the way we educate the pastors of the future, it seems to me, has to be different. And it has to include something in our curriculum that will help them as a part of learning theology, as a part of learning preaching, as a part of learning pastoral ministry, that will help them meaningfully connect with the men and women in their churches who spend the vast majority of their lives in the workplace. In fact, the amount of time they spend in the workplace dwarfs and will probably always dwarf the amount of time they spend in our local church, even the most involved people. And so to assume that somehow what happens inside our church building is the front lines of their service to Christ, I think is doing both the local church and the individuals a disservice. Now, I try to regularly, I teach a regular course in the MDiv program where I get a chance to integrate a lot of the stuff on a theology of work and vocation and calling and economics. And as a part of that, and I ask our business students this too, but in a little different context, but I try to ask my seminary students regularly, How is it that business people, professional, working place folks, how are they perceived in the churches in which you serve, particularly vis-a-vis those men and women who are drawing paychecks from a church or some other Christian organization? And I get some really interesting answers to this. Some of these are on the handout that I've sent around. I think the most the one that got my attention the most was when this one woman said, she said, yeah, business people in my church are viewed as pockets to be picked. And I thought, God help us if that's the way they are viewed. Sometimes, though I think, to be fair, I think we need to admit that there are many cases in which people who do have what I would call a spiritual gift of giving, usually that goes with a spiritual gift of making money as well, get huge amounts of joy out of funding various things in their local church. Many of them, like the Kearns, refuse to accept any sort of public or formal recognition for it. And I think generally, I think what my students need to know is that churches collect revenue; they don't generate it. And so the various acts of altruism and charity on the part of the people who have the resources is an essential part of keeping our churches running. But for far too many business professional folks, that's the limit of where they see their contribution to God's kingdom. And my students also suggest that there are that business people are perceived as providing some sort of professional expertise to help administrate churches, which can be very complicated business operations. I've asked pastors about that, and that gets actually very mixed reviews because they recognize that business people sometimes don't always catch the distinction between a business and a local church, that those are two fundamentally different things. In many cases, my students will tell me that what they recognize is that in the workplace, sort of the value of the Christian business person in the workplace is they have what I call a strategic soapbox for living out and proclaiming their faith in ways that are unique. Many of our seminary students, they recognize that sort of what Tom was suggesting this morning, where once he's identified as a pastor, you know, that builds up a certain amount of walls, and that the business people in our churches and the contact that they have with people who they work with, who will likely never darken the doors of a church, is way more advantageous to seeing a person's faith lived out than the average pastor who they're with an hour or two a week. I get a kick out of the business students, especially, who lament that they fear going to these offices or these companies where they may be the only believer who's in their particular workplace. And I look at them with this real serious look on my face, and I think, you mean to tell me that what you're afraid that God is going to entrust that entire outfit to you? And I said, really? I mean, God is showing huge amounts of trust in you that he would trust that whole place to you. And I think that's not quite in their categories when we have that conversation. But then my students, and this is where my business students kick in, is that we often ask about business students, how are you perceived around Biola University, around our Christian university, where you've got majors in biblical studies, majors in Christian education, majors in, you know, the arts and music. And they frequently tell us that, though it's getting better, that business students are often perceived as being greedy. They're often perceived as being somehow less spiritually with the program, and that they feel like they are somehow doing something less than for God's kingdom than people who are majoring in other things that might be more pastoral or parachurch oriented. And though I think that reflects some of the not so positive things that my seminary students tell me about how business people are perceived in their church, if they're really honest about it. Sometimes my students tell me that business people see themselves as not on the front lines of what God's doing in the world. I was a very prominent Christian camp. You're probably not familiar with it since it's on the West Coast. You may be, so it'll be unnamed. But my youngest son was there with a high school group of the church. We had to take him up there because he had missed the bus because he had another commitment. So my wife and I decided to stay at the camp for a few days and take some vacation. In the evening, they have programs where a very prominent pastor came in to speak in the evening. So we decided to go. And this pastor, I don't know how he got on it, but he was describing a relationship that he had with a very prominent business person in his church. And he was quoting the business person, and he put it like this. He said, "Pastor, you're on the front lines, and I'm the supply line." And I'd like to think that if my wife hadn't been with me, I would have stood up and said, "Are you sure you want to say it quite like that?" Because I remember thinking to myself, what a bass-ackwards view of the church. To think that the front lines of what God's doing in the world is when we gather in the church building. So where do we get that idea? Rather, what the New Testament teaches is that what goes on inside the local church is the equipping station for what takes place in the front line, which is out there in the world, in the workplace, in neighborhoods. It would be the equivalent of somebody going to boot camp and saying, "I'm going to stay in boot camp because that's where the action is." Say, no, you go to boot camp to prepare to go out to the front lines. And I wanted to raise my hand to this pastor and say, have you really thought through your ecclesiology on this? People who work in the marketplace often feel like they are doing something less for God's kingdom than people who are getting paychecks from churches or other Christian organizations. And I think that is more often than not reinforced inadvertently in our churches. I have seminary students who will say things like, "I left my business to go serve the Lord full time." And I look at them and say, I'm tempted. I'm trying my best to be gentle. But I'm tempted to say, "Where did you learn such terrible theology?" Or they'll say something like, I left my business to go into vocational ministry. We were visiting a church last week, and the pastor described himself as being called to professional ministry. Or they'll say, I'm so excited to be entering the ministry. Or when a pastor steps down from a church, we describe it as what? They've left the ministry. Some of this we get from the book Halftime. Probably only a handful of us, I think, are old enough for that book to actually be relevant to us. So I'll talk to the three or four of us. You're clearly in that group. don't fight that one. But if you're familiar with the concept, it's I'm not sure this is actually what was intended, but I think this is the way it's clearly been interpreted. That when you reach the halftime point of your life, where you've been there, done that in business, your kids are raised and up and out of the house, and you're ready to do an assessment of life and to move from what the author calls from success to significance. And in the second half of your life, you're supposed to be about kingdom work. And I want to say, what on earth do you think you've been doing in the first half of your life? Amen? I think some people will say, actually I've been serving myself, and I want to do something different. Or I'll assess my gifts and do something different. But what I wonder is, what do we say to the business person who says, "I've reached halftime, I've done that reassessment, and I'm staying in business"? Oftentimes, I think in our churches, we say, no, you need to do that all over again and try, come at this another time. I was in your student center last night, and I saw I don't know if this is true, your student body here, but there were a disproportionate number of students in the student center last night who were Asian. And I don't know if your school is like ours, but being on the West Coast, we have let's just say our Asian students, that population is what's keeping us in business. We have probably 40% of our students are of Asian descent, and the full 25% of our students are Korean. And we find that there are cultural issues that make this sort of this hierarchy of callings much more pronounced. And the idea of getting a theology of work that reflects the biblical teaching to really take root among our students of Asian descent, I found to just be incredibly challenging. And even the Asian students who get this, I'll ask them, is this something you can actually talk to your pastor about? And they'll say, oh, absolutely, I could never broach this with my pastor. Which I found, really challenging to get them to minister a theology of work in a context that won't cost them their job. And so they have to use a significant amount of wisdom in order to make that happen. In any case, I'll give you one other example of this. Increasingly, I don't know about here, but increasingly our students at Talbot go under the heading of bivocational, where they're doing something in the workplace to pay their bills and pastoring for whatever other amount of time they have. I'm not quite sure how they pull all that off if they're raising a family. But the number of bivocational students that we have is growing almost exponentially. And it is a trend that I think is going to affect the pastorate on an ongoing way, which we're just beginning to think about how that affects the way we deliver theological education. That, in my view, is going to have a profound effect on what theological education is going to look like in the next 10 to 15 years. But it's very interesting to listen to our bivocational students who are aiming to be pastors, because they will talk about their job in terms of, well, it's just my job. It's strictly a means to an end in order to pay their bills so they can do the thing that God is really calling them to, which is what they're doing in the local church. And see, I think that this sort of general sense among business people, professional folks, about that they are somehow doing something less than for God's kingdom compared to pastors and missionaries and others who are drawing full-time paychecks from churches, I think is a really serious problem that we have inadvertently reinforced in our churches. So this is why I think it's so important that our seminary students and the next generation of pastors get this right, and that they start to preach and teach in their settings, affirming the dignity and value and nobility of, within a few things that are clearly outside the bounds, but all of our earthly work. Right? Now, Tom went through a lot of the theological foundations for this. Let me touch on just a couple of things that relate to this. Obviously, the Bible is really clear that there are instrumental reasons why God calls people to the workplace. Now, one is you have to support your family. Some of the strongest language in the Scriptures is reserved for those who drop the ball on that responsibility. Second, I think the Bible is very clear that we work in order to have generosity, particularly toward the poor in our community. Seems to me that developing that heart for the poor is a non-negotiable component of faithfully following Christ. But these are instrumental reasons. And I think the strategic soapbox idea has merit also to it. But these are instrumental reasons only. Most, in my experience in my own church and among my students, most people view the value of God's calling them to the workplace only in these instrumental terms. And it's very rare that they have considered the intrinsic value both to God and to the common good of what goes on in the workplace. I think what the Bible teaches is that our work in the workplace has intrinsic value in terms of serving Christ. That I think if our business professional folks understood this, it would radically change the way they thought about their workplace. Now, I'm not going to go back through Genesis 1 and 2. I will say this, though, that thankfully, when I asked my students whether work was ordained in Genesis 2 or 3, most of them get that right. When I ask groups of business, professional, workplace folks whether work was ordained in Genesis 2 or 3, there's a lot more ambiguity about that in their responses. And I tell my students that most of the workplace people in their ministries live their lives as though work were ordained in Genesis 3. They live as though their work is their penalty, and I suspect that virtually everyone that my students will minister to, if they won the lottery today, they would quit working tomorrow and go live a life of leisure. And if the stories of past lottery winners is any guide, watch their lives get ruined, usually in less than 12 months. The Bible's clear that work was ordained prior to the entrance of sin. Work is not a curse, though it was cursed by sin. And I'm going to focus on the other bookend of paradise for just a minute. Tom did a great job of walking us through that and how that relates to the dominion mandate. Although I think one of the huge tasks for economists to continue to work out in conversation with theologians is how to put a lot more shoe leather on the specific connections between economics and the dominion mandate. I've tried to get some of my philosophy students to take that on as some research projects. But here at the other bookend of paradise, when the kingdom is consummated after the Lord returns, it seems to me that we will still be working then, and work takes a prominent place there. In fact, when the prophets describe the kingdom coming in its consummation, they use figures of speech like they will beat their swords into what? Plowshares, and their spears into pruning hooks. The implements of war not only will be done away with, but they will be transformed into the implements of productive work, which suggests to me that even after the Lord returns, you and I will still be working. Okay? Now, my students are not thrilled about hearing that, and I think the people in their ministries are probably less thrilled about hearing that. But I think there's merit to that theologically. Now, I'm not too sure about the drawing a paycheck part, though I suspect that when the kingdom is consummated, we will still have exchange. We'll still have a medium of exchange. It will just be devoid of sin, corruption, and oppression. Okay? But I'll leave that to the specialists in eschatology to work that out. But it seems to me both work being ordained prior to the entrance of sin and its connection with the dominion mandate and its connection with this idea of God being portrayed as a worker and human beings being made in His image. All of those things, I think, suggest a very strong theological basis for seeing the intrinsic dignity of all legitimate work and all of the things in which we can endeavor to make an honest profit. Now, I think you can also suggest there's an eschatological dimension to this as well. I'd refer you to Miroslav Volf's work in the Spirit on this, where he suggests that that spiritual gifts are not limited to what he calls ecclesiastical activity or what we commonly refer to as church work. But he argues that in the New Testament era under the order of redemption, God has gifted individuals to prepare people for works of service, both for the church and for the common good, and that those gifts are extend to not only what takes place in the church, but also takes place in the workplace as well. Wolf suggests that it's the Spirit who imparts gifts and acts through them as a guarantee of the realization of the new creation. He links the activity of the Spirit with the transformation of the earth. And I think Tom got it right on that it's a transformation, not a starting over. And so Wolf summarized it like this. As Christians do their everyday work, the Spirit enables them to cooperate with God in the kingdom of God that completes creation and renews heaven and earth. I know for a fact he's not a postmillennialist either. Thus, work is not only a fulfillment of the dominion mandate, but it is also a service to God that cooperates with Him in the transformation of the world. Now, so we could go a lot further into the image of God. I see the image of God as primarily a status as opposed to a specific set of functions. Because the idea that it's certain functions makes me a little nervous, because as long as those functions are degreed properties, such as rationality and morality, that suggests the image of God is also a degreed property, which ought to theologically make us very nervous. So I take it the image of God has to do with more of a status as opposed to a specific set of functions. Now, I think we have those functions. We have rationality because God is a rational God. We have morality because we have a moral sense because God has infused the creation with morality. But I don't specifically link those functions with the image of God per se. So in the workplace, we represent the Creator God in our work by the exercise of what I think the best heading for this is probably entrepreneurial traits. We represent the entrepreneurial activity of God. We represent the status that God has given to human beings by the way we live out our lives. And one of the places we predominantly do this is in the workplace. Tom is exactly right to show that in Genesis 1, God comes right out of the chute as a worker and resting from his work at the end of Genesis 1. And throughout the Old Testament, it's very clear that God is involved intricately in sustaining and maintaining his creation. And Jesus, in one of his strongest claims to deity, claimed that on the Sabbath he was working as his heavenly Father was still working. And so it seems to me that a part of being made in the image of God, as Chuck Colson puts it, that we are hardwired to work. And I think Dorothy Sayers got it right. And the corollary to the phrase that Tom quoted from Sayers about work not just being something we do to live, but the thing we live to do, is her advice to the carpenters of her day. I mean, some of you may be familiar with this, that her advice to the carpenters when they came to faith was not just to come to church and not get drunk on the weekends. You know what her first bit of advice was? That they ought to make good tables. That there was something intrinsically valuable about making good tables that brought honor to God. I think this is why, this is one of the reasons, at least one of the reasons, why Solomon in Ecclesiastes can say this about our work. Though it is not to be considered the be-all and end-all, Solomon's very clear about that. But in Ecclesiastes 2:24, he puts it like this: a person can do nothing better than to eat and drink and find satisfaction in all of their toil. This too I see is from the hand of God, for without him who can eat or find enjoyment? And then likewise in Ecclesiastes 3, in 12 and 13, I know that there's nothing better than for people to be happy and do good while they live, that each of them may eat and drink and find satisfaction in all their toil. This is the gift of God. I take it that this is not a sort of pseudo-Epicurean philosophy here. This is sober realism about how to live in a deeply fallen world. Now, it seems to me one of the central texts that speaks to this is Paul's teaching in Colossians 3. I'm really grateful Tom didn't steal my thunder on this one. Because Paul has very stark words to say to the Colossians. Beginning in verse 23, it says, in whatever you do, which admittedly that's a fairly big tent. Right? Now, we'd say there are a few things that fall outside of that, but not very many. In whatever you do, work at it with all your heart as working for the Lord, not for human masters, since you are. Since you know that you'll receive an inheritance from the Lord as a reward. Now, I think what I would put in parenthesis here before that next phrase, in whatever you do, to carry on that idea from the context, it's the Lord Christ whom you are serving. Okay? Now, if you look carefully at this, you'll find this was written to a specific class of workplace men and women. It was written, you can see in verse 22, the context is set, slaves, obey your earthly masters in everything. Slaves, in whatever you do, work at it with all your heart. Slaves, in whatever you do, it's the Lord Christ whom you are serving. I find that very revealing, that one of Paul's central teachings about the dignity of work is addressed to slaves, who in the ancient world arguably did the most mind-numbing, meaningless grunt work that you can imagine. Yet Paul affirms that their work not only has dignity, but that their work, the work itself, is a part, not the whole, but a part of their service to Christ. That they are serving Christ when they serve their earthly masters. And I think to make sure we get this is the part I think that our business people, in my experience, routinely don't get right. Because I'll ask the business person, I say, well, tell me about your ministry in the workplace. And they'll say, well, I pray for my coworkers. I do my best to live out my faith. You know, when I have opportunity to talk to people about Christ, I will. Every once in a while, somebody will say, well, I lead a Bible study at lunch or after hours at my work. Or I have a small group for my church that meets in my workplace. Hardly ever do they mention anything about the work that they actually do during the day. And it struck me, I realized that when they talk about their ministry in the workplace, the things they refer to are all of those things when they are not doing their jobs. And I realized, if you best not do too much of that, lest you be guilty of theft of time from your employer. And I think what Paul's affirming in Colossians 3 is that the very work itself is what constitutes part of their service, or their diakonia, their ministry, their service to Christ. And see, this is the stuff that I think is really relevant to the theological education component and to the pastors, is the connection to work and, quote, ministry. Because if we read the New Testament carefully, it seems to me that the term for service and ministry is both, those are both common translations of the term diakonia. I would give anything if we had resisted the urge to transliterate that into deacon. That's completely misleading way of understanding that. And if you look in Acts chapter 6, for example, you'll see how these are used interchangeably to describe two quite different things. It said, in those days, when the number of disciples was increasing, the Hellenistic Jews among them complained against the Hebraic Jews because their widows were being overlooked in the daily diakonia of food, the daily ministry of food. So the 12 gathered all the disciples together and said, it would not be right for us to neglect the diakonia of the Word of God in order to wait on tables. Okay? Not because there was anything superior to the service of the Word as to the service of waiting on tables. It was that God had specifically called the apostles to the ministry of the Word and to prayer. But I think the point of this is that the term diakonia is used to describe both the mundane service and the, quote, more spiritual service that the apostles were engaged in. And I think I would actually prefer to use the term service as opposed to ministry. I think it's actually a lot clearer and less confusing. I think it's so important that our pastors get this, and the people in the workplace get this, that the very work they do is a significant part of their ministry. We have in our school of business, we have a big banner. It's probably the size goes from here, all the way over here and from ceiling to floor, that you can't miss it when you walk in the doors of the business school. It says business as ministry. And I remember thinking about that. There were a lot of different ways that they could have said that. You know, they could have said business and ministry as two different things that are related maybe by instrumental value. Or they could have said ministry in business, which would have the idea that I think that most business people have of their service in the workplace. But I think they said it exactly right, as business as ministry, business as a part of a person's service to Christ. And I may have missed them, but I have never yet met a person who claims that all of their service obligations to Christ have been met simply by virtue of them going to work. Almost everybody I talk to recognizes that we have service obligations in a variety of different settings, in our homes, our neighborhoods, around the world, and in the workplace. And getting to a point where we see that the work itself counts as part of their service is hugely important for them to be able to see. This is why we tell our business students, accounting is ministry. Auditing somebody's books well is a form of service to Christ, which is why you better attend to your classes so you can do this well. My son's a filmmaker. Filmmaking is your ministry. Now, it's not all of it, but it's a significant part of it. So really do it well. Right? We say marketing is ministry. Okay? From the marketing guy, I figured you'd appreciate that.
Thank you.
Okay? Finance is ministry. Though I'd like to talk to some of the bankers on Wall Street about that. But I think for the Christian, banking is ministry in that it serves the common good by making capital available. Right? Now we can go on and on with that, but you know, all of the disciplines that we teach in the university are service. That's why Biola University is a university and not a Bible college anymore. So it seems to me that part of the way we talk about this makes a really big difference. I'll get to more of that in just a second. I remember when we did our Talbot faculty retreat like this, we invited actually, we had all our faculty were there, and I think we had probably 12 to 15 CEOs of various companies that were in the geographic vicinity of the school. At the end of the retreat, it was sort of at this time of the year too, it was the start of the school year, and we had a handful of new faculty that we commissioned to their work in the school. But we also commissioned the CEOs in a formal commissioning to their ministry in the workplace. And it was really a powerful time. And we had comments from a number of them afterwards that said, you know, we feel like we are partners with you guys in the transformation of the workplace and in preparing pastors to equip the next generation. And they felt like we really had a stake in what they were doing in the workplace. And I know Tom does this at Christ Community, but at various times of the year, they commission various segments of the business community to their work in the workplace. And I often wondered, you know, why don't we do that more often? You know, we send out, I don't know, the college may do this too. At Biola, we send out probably half a dozen short-term missions teams every summer, and we have a January interterm where they go out too. And we send them out with significant fanfare, and justifiably so, because those are huge steps of faith that they're taking. But I remember thinking to myself, why don't we do something similar for our film students who they're going to go do internships at NBC, CBS, Universal Studios, arguably, in my view, just as big a step of faith and just as foreign a culture as they'll see anywhere around the world. And we don't do squat to commission them. Or our accounting students who are going to go internships at the big, you know, five, however many big accounting firms are left today. Whatever it is. And in our churches, we've got really well-established tracks for people to run on if they express an interest in being a pastor or missionary. But we got no, at least in my church, we got no tracks for people to run on if they express an interest in going to law school or if they want to start their own business. We've got people in my church, we have serial entrepreneurs in my church. And none of their talents are being put to use to mentor young men to see entrepreneurial activity as a part of their service to Christ. I don't even think the entrepreneurs themselves get it, that that's part of their service to Christ. And so I think ensuring that our language, that our language matches our theology is really important. Because when people tell me that that they're coming to school to go to full-time ministry, I say, you're doing nothing of the sort. Because being in full-time service for the King has nothing to do with where you get a paycheck from. Right? Amen? I would expect a little more from a Baptist group like this. Right? Because at what point does a person enter full-time service for the King? What's that? At the moment they come to faith, right? And what you do when you decide where you're going to get a paycheck is maybe change arenas of service. Think about how how the workplace person hears that in our churches. Because if they hear that the pastors are in full-time ministry, what does that say to them about what they're doing in the workplace? Their conclusion is at best they're in part-time service or in no-time service. And that if they're really going to make it count for God's kingdom, they got to leave their business, come to seminary, and go to a job where they get a paycheck from a church. Right? Now, I'll grant you, some people are called to do that. Fine. And it may be that it's better for them subjectively to do that. But I don't think the Bible teaches that it is better in an objective sense. It may be better subjectively because that's a better fit for their particular gifts or skills and sense of calling. But I think if what we've suggested about a theology of work is true, then what that means is that what goes on for the Christian business person in the workplace is God's work in the world, analogous to what pastors are doing as God's work in the church. And if that's true, then it seems to me that what goes on in the workplace has eternal significance. And it's not just doing church work in the workplace that has eternal significance. It's the very work itself that does. So when I hear about a pastor stepping down and they say they're leaving the ministry, I look at them with a really alarmed look in my face that says, surely you haven't given up your faith. Which is, I read the New Testament is about the only way you leave full-time service for the King. I think even when you die and go to be with the Lord, you are entering another arena of service. I wish we would stop talking about secular jobs. There's no such thing. I wish we would stop talking about front lines ministry as though we have the really odd conception that what happens in the church building is the front lines. That I'm still not quite sure where that came from. We have a church in our community that they have a big 4th of July parade. The church is right along the parade route. And they open up their facilities to anybody who wants. They provide water and snacks and restroom use. And all the volunteers, we went one year and saw all the volunteers have T-shirts that say the logo of the church on the front. And on the back, it says, as you're presumably watching someone walk out, leaving the church, it says, the church has now left the building. I think that, and they have left the building in order to enter the front lines of service. Just for myself, I try never to use the term ministry without some sort of qualifier to delineate the specific arena of service. So I try never to refer to the pastorate as the ministry. That's pastoral ministry. Or the mission field is that's missionary or evangelistic ministry or college ministry. But I think it's just as appropriate to refer to somebody who works for an accounting firm as being an accounting ministry. Or my son who works for a film production studio as being in filmmaking ministry. And it seems to me they all of them are in full-time service. And if what we said about a theology of work is right, then I think the hierarchy of service goes out the window, because these are simply different arenas of service that we are called to by virtue of our gifts, skills, talents, and sense of where God is taking us. So Tom is right on that language really matters. And so I try, when we're in the midst of these discussions with my students, I sometimes will keep a little tally on the whiteboard of how many times people use full-time ministry to describe the pastorate or ministry without a qualifier attached. Because I think if we just changed the way we referred to this with our students and pastors with our churches, I think that would be, in my view, that would be a huge step forward. Let me close with this. This is a couple stories, and then we'll take a couple questions on this. I remember at this retreat that we did, this was, I think, 3 years ago, 3 years ago, yeah, 2011. But one of the executives that we invited is actually a man who's on our board. And but if you take this, the iPhone 4, I think the iPhone 5 too, has that, if you can see, if you take the case off, you see that little silver metal strip that goes around the edge of your iPhone. I don't know if the 6 has it yet, but we have a businessman on our board whose company makes that metal strip. And needless to say, he's a very successful business person. The company, this is actually the second company he started and taken public. The first one, when he took public, he was on the front page of the Wall Street Journal. He's also been on the Wall Street Journal for some other things that we'll talk about later. But this most recent company, the product is called Liquid Metal. And it's advertised, at least, to be as strong as steel but flexible like aluminum, which apparently was why Apple was attracted to it, to form the board or the iPhone. He's Korean. He grew up as a son of a pastor. And I remember talking to him in the retreat. We were interviewing him up front, and so we were asking him, how did you deal with this sort of coming from a pastor's family where there was huge pressure to become a pastor? And he said, I remember how I felt when I finally realized that God had called me to be a business person. He said, I felt gypped because I felt like God was calling me to something that was second best for his kingdom. And I realized, wow, if that was communicated to him, probably never directly by anybody, but indirectly, he got this sense that he was doing something less than for God's kingdom. I thought that struck me as particularly tragic, especially since he was raised in a pastor's home who, in my view, theologically should have known better. The other one comes from a very dear friend who he and I talk about this stuff have in the past at some length, but he was describing how he and his wife were on their way back home from a European vacation. And as they got off the plane on the jetway, she collapsed and blacked out, completely unconscious, on the jetway coming home. And it turned out, make a long story short, that they rushed her to a neurosurgeon. She had a tumor about the size of a quarter at the base of her brain that threw outpatient surgery with what's called a gamma knife technology had just been developed at the time. The tumor was excised with minimal collateral damage to the surrounding brain tissue. and minimal recovery time. She went home that same day, and just really incredible stuff. And I remember my friend, as he was reflecting on this, he marveled at all of the different occupations that had to come together to facilitate his wife's healing. And I'm sure he was thinking about things as, you know, like the real estate people who leased the space to the surgical suite. But what he was particularly taken with was the team of men and women, likely a team, that designed the imaging, that wrote the imaging software to enable the surgeons to pinpoint exactly where this tumor was. And I'll never forget what he said. He said, again, it's assuming that the people who wrote this were believers, but he said, "I am so glad that the people who wrote that software didn't decide to leave their business to go serve the Lord full time." And I thought, that he got it. That, I thought, hallelujah. Because I think that's right. That the work, it's not just the things that are adjunct to the work in the workplace that count as ministry, it's the very work itself that matters.